Wines lecturing there, then went to
Colorado. They don't know. They're not.
Oh, of course, School of Wines is in Colorado. It's the Caltech of Colorado, we call it, right?
Right.
And of course, his main effort was with Texas A&M. He was chairman of the mechanical engineering department. He is at this time a distinguished professor at Baylor University, and his heart is with appropriate technology. I had heard of his reputation years before because he was on this faculty team with Campus Crusade, giving talks and seminars on Christian design. But then we both linked through appropriate technology, and then I even talked to him to go into Armenia, which he did last year. Last year and this year. Oh, that's right, twice. So wonderful. So when he will be talking about the global poverty center, have they approved it? You said you were going to try it. They proposed it.
We'll know in about a week.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
So Walter, it's all yours.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for being here. I wasn't sure we'd have an audience so late, and so I appreciate your taking this time to come. Like my colleagues, I sort of came to this interest. Late in the ball game, I spent most of my career making very high-performance, high-priced composites for the Air Force and the oil industry that regular people couldn't afford, much less poor people. And now, in the last 5 years, I've kind of shifted toward working for people who really can afford very little and trying to figure out how to help meet their needs. I want to speak to you today about a program that has gradually emerged over the last 4 years at Baylor out of the appropriate technology activities that we have started within engineering and have gradually involved our people from business school and more recently from the seminary in a very, very exciting partnership. What does the Bible say about the poor? Well, I think we've already mentioned this maybe at different points in our conference, but let me mention one more time. Jesus saying, the king will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these my brothers, you did for me. I think as we serve the poor, it's our way of giving to Christ. I know in our family, we like to adopt a poor family at Christmas every year. When you think, what are you going to give Christ for Christmas? It's really his birthday we're celebrating, and giving to the poor is a way to do that. In Luke 12:48, from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded, and from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. As I said at the beginning of our program, I think those of us who both have grown up in and lived in a part of the world that is both blessed with a lot of material well-being and also have training in science and technology, we are doubly, in some sense, both responsible and have the opportunity to be able to give through our professional training and spiritual gifting as well as through the material blessings that we have. And then I really like Proverbs 19:17, he who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will be rewarded for what he has done. Well, I'm going to breeze through quickly just a few statistics. The World Wealth Pyramid emphasizes the fact that there are a very small number of people who make significant money and a huge number of people who make very little. If you look at the distribution of incomes around the world, you can see sort of where poverty is worse. Red being worse, brown is next, yellow is a bit better, and of course green is good. And it's obvious that the biggest part of the world lives in the financial difficulty. It's sort of difficult to imagine that so many people live without things we take for granted: clean water, sanitation, electricity, food. It's hard to imagine how many people live with no adequate housing, who don't have access to electricity. I think once in a while, we have tornadoes in our town, and the water and the power may be off for 6 hours. And everybody's totally paralyzed, because without water and power, I mean, we really can hardly function. And yet, for some people, this is their ordinary, everyday experience. And when I have to do without these things, even for a short period of time, it really causes me to think what my life would be like if that was every day, if that was sort of the standard. 90% of today's engineering design work is done for the richest people. Only 10% is done for that poorest, huge majority of people. Some examples of things that have been done. Oops, this isn't supposed to be going so fast. But let me mention at the end of this. I imported that from another presentation. I didn't do it right. One of the ways that I wanted to share several examples of the kinds of things that technology can do to dramatically impact the lives of people. In the series of slides that just went by at a fast rate, one of the problems today is the biggest number of poor people own a small amount of land, but the land size they own is getting smaller and smaller. And the question is, why is that? Well, everybody has multiple children. And if you have 10 acres of land and you have 5 children and you end up dividing that up amongst those, over time, the plot sizes get smaller and smaller and smaller. Unless people are doing something to increase their productivity in their farming, then in fact their incomes are being reduced proportionally. And so one of the things that could be done and has been done by a fellow named Paul Podolak and an organization called IDE is to develop a very, very cheap drip irrigation system. And with his drip irrigation system, he's been able to help a huge number of people, I think about 60,000 people, to increase their income by $30 or $40 million per year. So the amount of income that he's been able to help these people generate is quite remarkable, because they were growing crops that could only be grown in a serendipitous water situation, and with drip irrigation they can move to things like fresh fruits and vegetables, which are much, much better cash crops, but you can't grow those if you don't have a consistent supply of water. So something as simple as a simple treadle pump that costs $80 and a drip irrigation system that costs about $100 per acre, and you can take a farmer who makes $400 a year and increase his income to about $1,200 a year. When we went to Kenya the first time, we actually met some people who had done exactly this. They dug a 25-foot hole, struck water, bought an $80 pump, put in a little drip irrigation system, and sure enough, every one of them said, yeah, our income's up by about 300 or 400%. And what a simple way to help a huge number of people. Paul Pollack says the key to appropriate technology is like real estate. Real estate, the three rules of real estate are what? Location, location, location. And he says the primary rule of appropriate technology is cheap, cheaper, and cheaper. Okay? You got to get the price down where the people can afford it. Here's a second interesting idea that shows exactly the kinds of things that we should be looking for and trying to imagine as we seek to help people. This is a lady with a telephone. Now, it's a cell phone, and somebody came up with the idea in Bangladesh, nobody has phone service. So if somebody were to buy a telephone and then to sell minutes on that telephone, then they would be able to probably service a very large number of people who can't afford a phone. But if they could buy 5 minutes per week or 10 minutes per week, kind of like I'm doing with my phone cards here, at the current price, that's about what I can afford, is about 10 minutes a week, it seems like, then a large number of people would have access to be able to communicate with their relatives and maybe their children and friends that are farther away, or maybe make critical phone calls having to do with wanting to sell their crops or whatever. And this one idea has managed to provide 250,000 businesses, these are mainly ladies who they've helped to finance with cell phones that then sell their minutes basically in their whole village, and now 60 million people in Bangladesh alone have been able to have phone service. Isn't that a clever idea? How do we empower people in poor parts of the world to be able to have a business, to have a job, to be able to generate income? So these are two ideas that have been done other places. Now, I want to share three examples of the kinds of things that we're doing at A&M and then share where we're headed with our Global Poverty Center. This is one that Bill Jordan talked about yesterday. There are many places in the world where access is a critical issue. If you grow a surplus crop, as people sometimes do, once they begin to have drip irrigation, they begin to have treadle pumps, which are really like these steppers that you go to in the exercise places, it's much better to do a pump with your legs and with your arms, and it's not good to have an electric pump because most of these places have no electricity. But if you can think of doing your stepper and pumping water, you can get your water pumping and your exercise in all at the same time. You grow a better crop, but now you've got to be able to get it to market. And in many cases, these people don't have access to market. So helping partner with organizations in Africa, such as Bridging the Gap Africa, to be able to build bridges is a way of allowing people to access medical care, education, and markets. This particular bridge costs $5,000, and we estimated, given the number of people that will use it, it will save about 2.4 million miles worth of walking per year. It's almost incomprehensible that for that little money, you could provide that much access. it's going to dramatically change the face of that village, where kids can now go to school, parents can access medical care, and the women don't have to carry 40 pounds worth of produce 20 miles to market every Saturday. And why the guys don't do that, I don't know. When I was there, I was sort of ashamed that the women did all the hard work. I think Bill showed this picture working on the second bridge that's 420 feet long, and he talked more about that yesterday, building it where there's crocodiles and hippos, so it should be exciting. Well, a second area that we've been working on that I've been particularly involved in is coconuts. We call our research group the Cocoa Nuts. When we started this, we were looking for an abundant renewable resource that was readily available in parts of the world where there were lots of poor people that could be potentially processed into high-value-added products. And as we investigated different options, we determined that coconuts were a really interesting option. We weren't sure if they would be a viable option or not. 50 billion coconuts per year grow in the world, plus or minus 20 degrees of the equator. Show the graphic on this. Plus or minus 20 degrees of the equator. If you draw that band, zone one, zone two, every country in that band has a majority of desperately poor people except one, and that's Singapore. So there's a huge number of coconuts in those parts of the world where there's a huge number of poor people. Furthermore, 96% of all the coconuts are actually owned by poor coconut farmers who make about $400, maybe $500 per year on average. And so our goal was to be able to figure out how to take these coconuts with village-level technology and help them to process those into value-added products worth about a dollar a coconut, at a minimum 60 cents. So if we can take six-cent coconuts and make products worth 60 cents, we could increase their income by about a factor of 10, from $400 to $500 per year, which is really bad, to $4,000 to $5,000 a year, which in most of these countries would be not great, but a lot better than what they've been doing. So what we want to do then is to figure out how we can use the coconut to make electricity, housing materials, cooking fuel, things to sell. What else could we do with a coconut? We've been working on this now for about 2.5 years. The average coconut tree produces 120 coconuts per year. Biomass, about 4 pounds. So that's about 500 pounds of biomass per coconut tree. And the question is, what could we do with all this biomass? Here's another picture. When the coconuts are at 9 months, they're green and they're juice. You can drink them. At 12 months, they've completely changed, and there's lots more interesting things we think you can do with the 12-month coconut. But the point is, these things are very, very abundant. One of the major causes of accidental death in these parts of the world is coconuts falling out of a tree and landing on people's heads. Now, here's what a coconut has on the inside. When we started this, I thought a coconut was what I bought at the store. It turns out what you buy at the store is not the coconut, it's the seed within the husk, and there's a lot more to the coconut than what I was buying at the store. If you open up the coconut, you'll find that it has a shell which is quite hard. It'll have a white meat called a copra. It will also have some juice which is fairly bitter. We all taste test every part of the coconut as we go along to say, could you really make something out of this like a drink? Or what's in the green coconut tastes very good. The coconut drink is quite good in the green coconut, but in the brown or beige colored coconut, it's turned bitter. And we've discovered that you could make vinegar out of this juice, but it's not very good for drinking. So in any case, these are the constituent parts. Now the question is, what can we do with these? Well, here's a nicer picture which shows more coconut meat in the coconut shell. Let's see what we can do with these. First thing we can do is we can take that coconut meat and we can, with very simple expellers, which only cost about $1,400 and no power requirements, we can actually squeeze out the coconut oil. It takes about 35 coconuts, 36 coconuts to make a gallon of coconut oil. When we first started this, we were only thinking electricity. And then we realized we have either a huge waste problem or a lot of free feedstock for something. With that coconut oil, we can do two things. We can either process it with methanol to make biodiesel, which is easy to do, and use it in electric generators to produce electricity, because the villages we're talking about have no electricity, and they've got lots of coconuts. So this would be a long-term source of electricity. The problem is methanol is also not readily available in these rural villages, so now we've been working on adapting our diesel engines to be able to burn the coconut oil directly, and have been able to demonstrate that you can actually, if you preheat the coconut oil to 90 degrees C, it will burn just like diesel fuel, and it's much easier to adapt the engine than to have to continuously modify the fuel. So we are this summer finishing up on some simple adaptive kits that can be used on diesel engines that would allow you to simply use the exhaust from the engine to preheat the coconut oil to be able to generate electricity in rural villages with nothing but coconuts. Second thing we decided is the husk is an interesting part of the coconut. You can separate the long fibers from the short fiber in the so-called pith, which is really a dried out sappy material. And if you use that, you can hot press it in particle board. Now the particle board that we've been hot pressing is twice as strong and three times as thick as what you buy at Lowe's, yet it's better because it has no binder. And in today's world where people want more green products, almost everything you buy in particle board at Lowe's is Lowe's is a major store, I suppose there must be a similar building material store in England, will typically have wood and lots of binder, and therefore it has some emissions. Basically has a small vapor pressure of whatever plastics or we're used to glue it together. It turns out that we can make with about 50 coconuts one particle board. It's worth $15 in the United States. Interestingly enough, it's worth $15 in Papua New Guinea. Now the difference is in Papua New Guinea, $15 is 2 weeks worth of wages for a typical person. So building materials in a lot of developing countries are not readily available. In many cases, they're even imported, which makes them quite expensive. So we think these are things that can be used in country immediately, or if we eventually get around to it, can help them to export these. The particle board is a very good application. We have free feedstock with all these coconut husks. If you go to a developing country where they're extracting the coconut oil, you'll find huge mountains of coconut husks and shell with almost nothing being done with it. If they do anything, it's to burn it maybe for fuel, but it's not widely used. So this is a great application for that. The coconut shell is twice as dense as the most dense hardwood. It's five times as hard as the hardest hardwood we have in the United States. It stores about twice as much energy, and we're looking at two different kinds of applications. We actually are looking at a stove in which a woman could use the coconut shell for cooking dinner, and if she cooks for the right length of time and then caps the stove, volatiles have been emitted, which will cook for about 20 minutes, then what's left is actually high-quality charcoal. So she could make dinner and make charcoal at the same time and then sell the charcoal in the city for a good price. But a second application, which my students are working on this summer, is you can finally grind the coconut shell, it's extremely hard, and use it as a reinforcement in engineering plastics, much like we use e-glass or other fillers. And this, I think, will bring a much, much better price point. So we think that with the high strength and hardness of these coconut shells, they will make a good engineering composite material kind of additive. Now, let me add, with the applications I've just shared with you, and there's some others that I won't take time to share, there's a lot of interesting things you can do with coconuts. The residual meal after we squeeze the oil out is 16% protein. It makes great feed for chickens, cows, and pigs, and they actually like it. You don't have to force them to eat it. You just throw it out there, and they go for it. You can use the long fibers from the husk to make netting or erosion resistance, and this is already a very, very commercial application that's being done with a coconut co-op in the Philippines that we're working with. They've actually created, just making nets, not anything else, jobs for 1,200 families in the Philippines. And 150 of those are former Maoist communist terrorists, and 100 of them are former Islamic terrorists. What these people really wanted were just opportunities to make a living for their family. They weren't necessarily driven ideologically. Okay, a second example is in Armenia, and I appreciate Ken getting me involved in this through some mutual, what have become mutual friends. In the wintertime, it's very cold. Children literally die by freezing. There's an extremely high cost of energy. It's high for them as it is for us, but they have a much smaller capacity to pay. When we went there a year ago, March, the schools that we visited were at 54 degrees inside, and this is in March. Okay, they can't afford to heat the schools. All the kids were wearing hats and gloves, and they all looked happy, which tells me it must be warmer at school than it is at home. Our goal is to be able to make a 2,000 square foot bedroom, 6,000 square foot, 600 square foot, two bedroom, one bath house And the 2,000 is a misprint there. It should be $12,000. We're working with George Shermanian and Stephen Iris Lazarian, and we have actually been this past summer to actually do this. Here's a picture that I took when I was there in June of a young girl, and until recently she lived with her family here. This is a metal shipping container, and many people in Armenia live in discarded metal shipping containers. Now, you know what kind of a great conductor metal is. When it's 20 degrees below zero outside, it's not going to be much better than that inside. And when it's 110 degrees outside, which it is in the summertime, much like North Dakota in the United States, it's going to be extremely hot. So housing is a huge issue for these people. Now, the concept that we're using is a foam block that's 4 feet long, a foot tall, 8 inches deep. It's like a giant Lego block. It has round pieces on the top that look like Legos and then recessed areas on the bottom. So you can actually stack these things up and you can actually build a house in an afternoon. But you'd say, well, what kind of a house is it going to be if it's all foam? Well, you can't have an all foam house. The round knobs on the top actually have holes drilled in them. You put rebar in there and you pour about every other one of those and you can completely make it structurally sound, having a concrete foam house where the foam actually is the form for the pouring of the concrete. Now,
that's styrofoam?
It's styrofoam. Yeah. It's styrofoam which has...
Recycled?
Huh?
Recycled?
You know...
New styrofoam?
You know, at this point, we haven't worried about the recycling because I don't know what the recycling situation is in Armenia. Our interest right now is making styrofoam blocks, and obviously, if you had enough styrofoam cups thrown away and if somebody was collecting those in some organized way, you could actually use recycled styrofoam. But the important point is, this is a house that we've been working on for about 2 hours, and this is what it looks like after about 4 hours, and this is what it looks like after about 1 day. We actually built two whole houses, putting in plumbing, wiring, roofing, everything, windows, doors, in less than 2 weeks of time. And so this is a great way to build a house quickly. Now, the problem is you can't sell to poor people a house for $12,000 or $14,000. But it turns out because this building approach is so quick and efficient and the energy efficiency is really high, the R values on these walls are 30. The R values on the traditional houses they make out of stone and concrete are about 5. So it'll be much more energy efficient, it's much quicker to build, we've been told that a house this size built out of traditional materials there would sell for about $30,000. So we think with the added cost of land, we can probably sell these for $30,000 and net $10,000 to $12,000 maybe. And if that's possible, then you could sell two houses and keep the proceeds from those to build a third house for a poor family that couldn't otherwise have it. We're trying to do all market-driven kinds of solutions. If they're donor-driven, then it's always going to be limited. It's much, much harder to do. So we think this has a lot of possibility. Now, where are we going with our Global Poverty Center? It's a partnership between the School of Engineering and Computer Science, the Business School, and Truett Seminary, all at Baylor. Our purpose is to provide opportunities rather than just charity to help people in developing countries. The idea of the concrete foam house was really to create a new industry of affordable housing that would create jobs for people and would generate profit within a nonprofit that could be used then to fund building houses for those people who couldn't afford to pay for one. So it's doing a bunch of things. It's providing housing for poor people. It's creating jobs for people in Armenia. We're working on trying to get every part of the concrete foam houses made in Armenia. So we're creating jobs and keeping the cost down by doing it that way. We want to have this be a holistic kingdom building, not just humanitarian. We want to use bottom-up approaches to alleviate poverty, and by bottom-up, we mean we want this to be market-driven. We want it to be something that will work in the marketplace on its own. We think that the kinds of opportunities we're trying to create, whether it's with our coconut project or the concrete foam houses, need to be things that will work as real businesses for real people in these countries. What they need are jobs, not just water, not just electricity. They need economic opportunity. We want to be able to utilize abundant renewable resources. The coconut is one example, but we're sure there are many others that will provide long-term sustainable approaches to alleviating poverty and providing economic opportunities for people. At this point, just to briefly share what we're doing at the campus, we're developing technology, and we have two sections of business every semester, about 50 students, that are doing social entrepreneurship as a course. In that particular course, the students develop business plans, and the business plans then we're using to actually develop ways of trying to deploy the technologies that we're developing as businesses in the developing countries that we're trying to work with. As our first example with our coconuts now, we actually have technology that we think can be, it's affordable, it can be used at a village level, it will produce enough cash flow to pay back all of the capital costs in about 3 years, and we're going to be trying within the next 12 to 18 months to be franchising, much like a McDonald's franchise, except this will be a nonprofit we're going to set up either under Baylor's umbrella or separate, we're not sure yet, that would try to provide franchises for for-profit businesses in villages that would be owned by the villagers. Either as a cooperative or maybe a subset of people in that village would be the primary owners. We would help them get loans, either from the World Bank or with venture capital, that's sort of a social venture capital kind of a deal. There are people who are willing to do that, and in fact I'm one of them, to be able to fund these and then have them pay back over time very, very quickly. With the franchise, what we would provide would be, for example, all of the technology sent in a shipping container. We would provide training and quality control. We would train them in how to do maintenance. We would provide business plans. We would provide business systems. And then we would provide ongoing consulting support. So that what we would be doing is essentially putting these people in business and then continuing to work with them to help them. In some cases, the products they're making would be readily sold in country. In other cases, they might get a better price point if they were able to sell it overseas. In the case of coconut oil, it can also be used as a good health food supplement. Or in the case of particle board, it brings a really good price in the United States. And maybe in Europe as well. The shipping costs are not prohibitive to be able to make it work price-wise. And so we would provide marketing on this end and do fair trade. I think a lot of things I've seen since I've been in England and in Scotland are fair traded, and I think this is a great idea too. I think people are willing today to make that a consideration in their purchasing, to be able to say, I want to do something where the profits for this are going primarily to the people who are developing the products. And so that's why we want our mother organization to be a not-for-profit, so that we're not, in a sense, at the request of our stockholders, having to try to gain as much profit as we can out of it. On the other hand, we want the people we're working with to be profiting at the highest level that they can for the products they're making. So this is just one idea of the kinds of things that we're trying to do. We hope we'll come up with lots of interesting technologies, business plans, and lots of partners. We're working with Christians in many different parts of the world who are very eager to be able to be our first, in a sense, franchisees on our coconut project.
Thank you, Walter. Time for questions, comments?
Well, it's a maintenance question. There are two questions on building a styrofoam block. Mm-hmm. How much do those Lego blocks weigh?
About 2 pounds.
But when you put them up and they're in, can somebody come along and punch it or hit it with something and damage it?
Well, they could. When we finish putting the blocks in place and pouring in place the concrete columns, if they punch at the wrong place, they're going to break their knuckle because the concrete columns are only spaced by about 11 inches. Okay. Secondly, though, we put about a quarter inch thick layer of plaster on the outside, so it looks like a stucco house in California. Okay. I think people wouldn't like to live in a house that looks like a foam house, even if that's what's behind the board. Okay.
But you can repair it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you could repair it. But, you know, we worried about that, and I hope people aren't so worried about security. If somebody wants to break into their house, it's much easier to break a window. You know, I mean, if you've got only 11 inches between concrete columns and you've got a quarter-inch plaster on the surface, if you're really trying to get in, the better way to get in would be just to break the window anyhow.
But the house can last 30 years.
Oh, it'll last indefinitely. Some people say the bad thing about styrofoam is it's not biodegradable, and I'm saying when you're building houses out of it, the good thing about styrofoam is it's not biodegradable. Okay? So, yeah, that works as an advantage, not a disadvantage. I'm not throwing it into landfills yet.
I really Well, you have, what you have to do in the styrofoam, you can put some fire retardant into your mix of styrofoam. That will help to avoid the problem. Sure, that's obviously an issue, and I think when it's made, it'll have to be formulated to include some fire retardant.
Where is the stove going to be?
Oh, well, yeah, and we plaster on the inside as well, so it won't have direct access to the foam, period. People don't like styrofoam look on the inside or outside, but I think beyond that, they've been making more and more houses in the United States using foam, sometimes with this design, or more often with concrete in the center and foam pieces on the outside, and they already have some good technology for doing flame retardant additives. They will help to minimize the potential danger.
Is that electrical stove? Is that in Africa they wouldn't have wood or coal?
Well, I think this works better where it's cold. I think one of the big advantages is it's energy efficient. I'm not sure price-wise you could do some other things that would make more sense. In Africa, because you've got lots of biomass, in Armenia, they essentially burn down all the biomass. If you drive around there, there's a few places where there's forest left, but no place near cities. And just burn it off the firewood over time, or in these four metal containers. And so it looks pretty desolate in terms of biomass there. So it's hard even to get wood for making the joist for the house. And I mean, it would be extremely expensive.
In fact, it's stone houses, and one of the issues is culture. Will they accept? They're so used to stone houses, and they want to live in stone houses. There's something that's way in the back there.
Yeah.
I just wanted to pick up on that last point, really, that there are firm concrete systems available in Europe, which already meets passive house standards developed in Germany and Austria, and they actually don't need any concrete.
They must be using. What are they using? The solar panels?
They're using silver passive house principles. They're using solar gains.
I've seen energy independent houses in the United States, and they're extraordinarily expensive. To be highly common. Because I think a lot of the things you have to make that work are not themselves cheap. There's a one time cost and then no energy cost. But for these people, can't get mortgages in them. So the going in cost is a big factor. Yes.
One more question, yes.
How easy is it to decide on which price? You must test a lot of prices before you go out and try them.
You know what, before we even work on the technology, we try to do a real quick upfront business assessment at the beginning to say if we develop the technology successfully, would it be viable in the marketplace? And if the answer is no, then we don't even bother. We go to the site to look at other ideas. So everything we're doing, we think, will work. Now, does that guarantee it'll work? The answer is no. But we'll know pretty soon with our coconuts when we can, when we think we can make 60 cents to a dollar on coconuts worth 6 cents, there's enough margin in there that the chances of it being successful are very high. Whether it'll be as successful as we like and have as big a margin for the people who are doing it is something that will depend a bit on how efficient we can be in, or how fit we can have them to be, really, in doing a lot of it, and then how much extra cost there are in some of the marketing issues. So we think there's enough margin in there. For example, in the United States, a lot of people are green for buying coconut oil, including me. It's really a great thing for energy, and it's a great thing for doing weight loss. It has all kinds of immune system benefits. A liter of virgin grass coconut oil sells for about $10. The half liter sells for about $10. And that's 60 cents worth of coconut. In fact, it's 30 cents worth of coconut and $1 or $10 for the price in the store. So there's a lot of margin in there to work with, and we're pretty confident this will work. Now, we're working with Christian groups in different places that we've already been in contact with. We're eager to try this out. But there also needs to be people who we think have some capability and credibility. The first project we're going to do is in Papua New Guinea with one of my PhD students. There's a professor there. And he's got a colleague of his who's an electric engineering professor who's taking early retirement to go to a remote island where he grew up. They helped the island for the first time have clean water and electricity because with electricity you can then make clean water and provide a lot of things. He really wants to go and do this for his own living.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. We're ready for our business meeting. Okay. Next story. That's what I did.